Your name?
Cortland Malloy.
Cortland Malloy, you've written a series of very eye-opening columns recently regarding education, schools, Chancellor Michelle Rhee, and Mayor Adrian Fenty. I wanted to start with Wednesday's from September 29th. It's entitled, Teaching Isn't Simply by the Numbers. And you give two examples of teachers who maybe these impact evaluations, this controversial way of measuring teachers, maybe they don't catch the full measure of some of the teachers in D.C.
Yes. And you would like to know a question? You have a question about it?
I would like you to elaborate and expand on your really excellent article.
Okay. The impact model for evaluating teacher performance is very numerically based. It's a statistical model which is designed to isolate these impact zones that a teacher will have on a student's learning. And you get various points for, well, some pretty nebulous things like whether you have a rapport with a student. And I thought that I would put some of the teachers that I've known over the years to the test. And these were teachers who, under the most trying circumstances, when the city was being racked by violence, a lot of poverty, were still able to make great gains in terms of moving students along, helping them achieve a modicum of academic excellence, really. And what I found was that there is an artistry involved in teaching that cannot be captured on some statistical test. And it has to do with the kind of personal attention that teachers routinely pay to students who are lagging behind, students who are having particular difficulties with their home life. And this impact model, which bases a teacher's really career on how well they're doing numerically over the course of a year. If that standard was applied to these teachers, they probably wouldn't have been around to do the good work that they did. Student achievement cannot be measured by a 30-minute observation by a so-called master educator, nor can it be looked at in terms of how a teacher does over the course of a year, because a lot of teachers will follow their students. And a lot of this just goes off the radar because teachers don't talk about, how they're devoting extra time to students. I found that a lot more teachers than are given credit for do this with a sense of altruism, and they teach because they love teaching. And that's what this piece was about, just to show that the love cannot be measured, the giving students a second chance cannot be measured, and restoring hope to a student who's about ready to drop out, who's feeling pretty hopeless and put up on. When a teacher turns that child around, there's no way to establish a data point for evaluating that, and I just wanted to bring that out in this column.
In the column you write, quote, "The extent to which teachers serve as surrogate parents for students has never been fully appreciated, and part of the reason is that teachers don't boast about it. Some of them will never list such work on a pay-for-performance eligibility form." And you go on to talk about Ann Jackson, who you followed since 1989, a sixth-grade teacher, as well as Sandra Howell. Talk about these two examples of teachers who impact might not bring the full measure of what they're doing in the classroom out and beyond the classroom.
Yes. Well, in the case of Ann Jackson, in 1989, the city was in the throes of a homicide epidemic unlike anything that had been experienced before. And a lot of her students were being impacted by that. And one of the ways that she decided to help offset those difficulties was to start her own weekend tutoring school, is what it turned out to be. There were so many students involved at a church. And this was not something that would be listed as part of a teacher's achievement. In fact, Ann Jackson did not go around saying, "Ooh, look what I'm starting this school." She just told these students that, you know, she wanted them there. Other students came. And over the course of the next 6 years, she worked with those students as they moved through the school system and others who came in on weekends. And 6 years later, in 1995, all of the 28 students in her class graduated, and 16 of them went on to college with more than $2 million in scholarships. And all of them fared, you know, pretty good. Even those who didn't go to college, they got jobs and that kind of thing. This kind of achievement, dedication of a teacher could not be recognized on a statistical model. And in the case of Sandra Howell, who did middle school work, you know, her students were, sometimes her students would just need a place to stay. They couldn't go home even. They didn't want to go out in the streets. And even today, if you look at one of the main concerns that students have that's still not, you know, really being addressed, is that they don't feel safe outside the school. And especially this impacts after-school activities. You know, you may start these great after-school programs, but if a kid says, "Hey, I'm getting out of here before dark because it's not safe," you know, you can't address that concern inside a school, a classroom. And this current testing evaluation system is so based on what happens in the classroom, such that Ms. Howell, Sandra Howell, bringing, you know, kids home with her, you know, and working with them there and taking them to church with her, which, by the way, some people think that, oh, they're indoctrinating them. No, church is a social, you know, entity where people do tutoring, mentoring. You know, there's a whole network of people that she introduced these kids to. And just work with them sometimes all night long to help a kid get a science fair project together. This is just not captured on a data point, and the progress that a student makes as a result of that just can't be determined that way. And for low-income students, in many cases, it's that kind of work that it takes to get them over the hump. And, you know, more teachers do that sort of thing than I think people realize. You know, a lot of, when the first round of firings, 229 teachers were fired, students got very upset because it was almost a wholesale, you know, slicing based on, you know, well, a standard that people still haven't been able to figure out, but it was certainly some kind of numerical equation. And for students for whom teachers had bought clothes when they were coming to school in winter without socks or coats, teachers took them to the store, bought clothes for them, helping them with school supplies and those kind of things. Those things weren't taken into account, and the students who had benefited from that were so upset that they staged a protest march last year that was as big as anything that I'd seen since the 1960s Civil Rights March, which is astounding. It was the first time it ever happened in this city like that, because students felt that by attacking the teachers who had helped them, that they had been, in fact, attacked by the school system that claimed that it had been set up to help them. So it's that kind of thing. It was striking to me and made me want to kind of highlight the old school way of some of the positive and most effective things that teachers had been bringing, you know, to reform, you know, schools by overcoming these obstacles that were, you know, impacting classrooms from outside of the school. And I wanted to point that out.
Cortland Malloy, tonight Waiting for Superman opens up, and it focuses on Michelle Rhee, the D.C. school's chancellor. And one of the things that Chancellor Rhee has been very adamant about is that poverty and teaching are really two separate things, and there are no excuses. I wanted to read one more quote from your article, Teaching Isn't Simply by the Numbers. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to discuss a little bit, that was on page the first page of the Metro section. Mm-hmm. On page A1 was an article entitled, D.C. and Region Show Disturbing Rises in Childhood Poverty. And I wanted to do what you've done such a good job of, which is connecting poverty. But first, the quote from Teaching Isn't Simply by the Numbers. Quote, no matter how great a teacher may be, there's no way you can educate a child who is not in class. Pretty hard to get a girl to perform well on a test if she's keeping some painful secret about being pregnant or abused. And sometimes, boys are kicked out of school for disruptive behavior before anybody discovers that a friend or family member had been shot to death. Jackson, this is Ann Jackson, who you described earlier, had a way of getting through, but it could take time, a year just trying to keep a student from dropping out, more time to get back on track. Wait a minute, no excuses, right? End quote. And that from your article, Teaching Isn't Simply by the Numbers. And then page A1 of the Washington Post from Wednesday has an article, and it begins like this. Quote, 3 out of 10 children in the nation's capital were living in poverty last year, with the number of poor African-American children rising at a breathtaking rate, according to census statistics released Tuesday. Among black children in the city, childhood poverty shot up to 43%, from 36% in 2008 and 31% in 2007. That was a much sharper increase than the 2 percentage point jump to 36% among poor black children nationwide last year. Nationwide, more than 1 in 3 black children is in poverty. Here in D.C., 43%, Cortland Malloy. We need, it seems, as you have done, to talk about poverty.
Yes, there are more than 50 years of research that shows a strong correlation between poverty and low education achievement. It is little wonder to me that after test scores were inching up over the years, and this is before Michelle Reed came, that's what people don't seem to understand, test scores were already going up. And as soon as this recession started having a big impact on the city, foreclosures involving where residents, where students live, homeless shelters that were built for 35 people, having 200 people jammed into them, people being displaced, people needing more food stamps and not yet getting, which suggests that children are not getting the food they need. These kind of things affect a student's ability to perform in school, and there's just no doubt about it. And you see that when all of a sudden, between the 2009-2010 test scores, progress stalled, and in some cases started reversing itself back to levels before Reed came. What you see is this achievement gap between white students and black students widening because because of this rise in poverty. So along with this, with the poverty and the widening of the income gap between blacks and white, you have now a continuing increase in the gap between blacks and whites on student performance. So there's just no doubt about it. One of the things with Michelle Reed's approach to school, and I think there are some good things in her ideas. I just don't think that she stayed true to the Teach for America beliefs, some of the core beliefs. She came to town having raised expectations that schools that had been most neglected would be given first priority, that even the best teachers would be put in those schools, because the whole point was to demonstrate that no matter what impact poverty might be having, it could be overcome by this diligent, intensive effort. Well, it turns out that may work on a classroom, and in some cases even a school. But she's demonstrated that it's much more difficult to do it system-wide. And within relatively short order, we found that she was paying a lot more attention to schools in more well-to-do areas than she was in areas that had been neglected so much before. And you have this recession coming to bear on it, and boom, there's been nothing about education reform that was able to stop its devastating impact.
And that impact has been different in different parts of the city. And I don't think that's been discussed much in the press, but it's hard not to miss. It was interesting. There was a critique of your column by Judith Schaefer. She wrote a letter to the Washington Post, and she says, "I wish Cortland Malloy would document his belief that schools chancellor Michelle A. Rhee focused more on white areas of town than on poor black ones. He should gather statistics and specify initiatives ward by ward. Then we can see if there is anything behind his claims," end quote. And first of all, to me, I mean, all you have to do is go towards, well, Ward 5 does not have a middle school. It does not have a single public middle school. It has the education campuses. Mm-hmm. To go see the schools in Ward 7 and 8, you know, which Ballou might have a nice sports field, but look at the condition of the school. So that someone could even write that speaks, I think, of a lack of spending time east of the river. But then I also wanted to just point out that Jerry Wiest, who's stepping down as superintendent in Montgomery County, he did really well. I think we've seen the opposite of here in D.C., which is he took resources, identified red and green schools, red schools being those most in need, and delivered more resources to those schools. But if you look at D.C., we really haven't done that. There's an example I hear before me, the middle school expenditures. Mm-hmm. Hart Middle School is getting a little more than $7,000 per student. And Hart is in East of the River in Ward 8. McFarland Middle School in Northwest is getting more than $13,000 per student. This has not been discussed. And so can you discuss this? And also, maybe this was reflected in the election that we just saw.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The election results in which the incumbent Mayor Adrian Fenty lost to the former D.C. Council Chairman Vincent Gray broke down in some significant ways. Most African Americans voted for Vincent Gray. Most whites voted for Adrian Fenty. And the schools that received the most help were in the white areas that supported Adrian Fenty. The schools that were neglected, even though people like this letter writer there claims that or implies that there has been no difference, knew better. It just stands to reason that if people were really seeing the kind of progress that everybody was claiming, there would have been no reason to vote, you know, against it. And this the idea that black people were somehow too dumb to know what was in their best interest became, over the campaign, very offensive, which only added to the wanting to hurry up and get Adrian Fenty and Rhee out. There is so the gap, as you know, between the rich and poor in this city is just widening tremendously, almost to the point that there is no contact between one side and the other, except for a very few really concerned. A lot of them are college students who kind of really, and this gives me some hope because people are saying, hey, something's screwy here, and we're going to go and work with people, you know, who need help. And they see that this incredible disparity is showing up in the way resources are, you know, devoted to schools, but also as the needs increase. Look, the city lost 12,000 affordable homes and apartments last year. Somehow 4,000 students have just disappeared out of the school system. And in those schools where most of these students came from, if they were poor, yeah, test scores did do a little, you know, blip up, as you would expect when you lose poor people out of the system. That doesn't mean that you're educating them. It means that they're just not there to bring your test scores down. However, as more and more children fall into poverty, the scores start going back down, and you're seeing some of that already now. But the fact that people don't know this disparity in allocation of resources, that white schools in white areas still get more than schools in black areas, is in part due to a kind of willful ignorance People don't want to admit it, but also it speaks to the effectiveness of Michelle Rhee's efforts to obscure what's really going on. It's like, as one city councilman said, and this guy really supports Michelle Rhee, he said, getting information from her is like just too hard. She will not, you know, communicate with people about what's going on. And that has kind of led to this impression that she's doing a lot better than she is.
And it's not just that, you know, 13,000 at McFarland and 7,000, you know, roughly at Hart, but McFarland, I'm guessing, has a, they don't even call them PTAs anymore, parent teachers associations. You see PTOs, parent teacher organizations, because they have real, they're really quite significant, and that's great. But it seems like if there was, when we're talking about like any type of parity, it's not just that funding should be flat, although we see it's almost double at the wealthier school, but there should be a real, even increase in more resources being devoted towards the school that are most in need, but that's not what we've seen.
Right, not at all. And, you know, part of it is that Michelle Rhee had no superintendent experience, that's why they call her a chancellor, no sense of how you, even if her best intentions was to put, you know, the best teachers or more resources in low-income areas, she had no clue about how to maneuver through the politics of a, you know, situation where, you know, people wanted, the more powerful people get what they wanted. And it's not new. Look, school reform efforts have been going on in Washington, D.C. since I arrived in 75. And you've had school superintendents like Arlene Ackerman who have tried to do, you know, similar things, reallocate, you know, the resources or just shift them around a little bit and run out of town because it's hard to do. Michelle Rhee had, however, the cleanest shot of any superintendent ever because the control board, having audited the school system back in 96 through Anthony Williams, the CFO, the chief financial officer who went on to become mayor, did an audit, found it was just a mess, as everybody thought, and said, we're going to clean this thing up and make it right. And this is more than 10 years ago. And it started, and when Anthony Williams became the mayor, he installed, he wanted to, you know, take complete control, but it wasn't until after he left that it happened. But during his time, he put in Clifford Janey, as superintendent, who put in place the same curriculum that Michelle Rhee benefited from and began the test score movement up. So say what you will about test scores. I didn't have doubts about how effective they really are, but under the No Child Left Behind movement. But Clifford Janey was making progress. When Adrian Fenty, the mayor, the new mayor, got control of the schools, the stage was set for the next superintendent to have a clear shot at what they were doing. And they brought in someone who only had 3 years teaching and was basically an education consultant. I think Michelle Rhee is probably a very good education consultant, but not a good superintendent or chancellor, because the same thing happened with her in terms of allocation of resources that it had happened before. Couldn't move the money from the well-to-do to the less fortunate, and that was just how it broke down.
I want to talk a little bit more about the election. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are saying, well, everything is getting better for people, so, you know, why, if things are improving, did people vote Fenty out? Maybe it was just, you know, his attitude. But I think you've pointed out something very important, and I wanted to read a quote from your column. D.C. election didn't just unseat abrasive mayor, it was a populist revolt. Quote, in a stunning repudiation of divisive autocratic leadership, district residents Tuesday toppled the city's ruling troika, Mayor Adrian Fenty, Attorney General Peter Nichols, and school's Chancellor Michelle Rhee, all busted up. The trio's contempt for everyday people was handed back to them in spades at the polls. Payback is a, well, you know what they say. What happened Tuesday involved more than just unseating of a mayor, with an abrasive style. It was a populist revolt against Fenty's arrogant efforts to restructure government on behalf of a privileged few. The scheme was odious. Recreate a more sophisticated version of the plantation style, federally appointed three-member commission that ruled the city for more than a century until 1967. The Fenty Troika eerily mirrored the old antebellum system of control, which featured a chairman for public works, which is what Fenty was, in essence, a chairman with expertise in legal maneuverings, Nichols, and a chairman of education and welfare issues, Ree. It all makes for a kind of friendly fascism in which D.C. government serves the interests of business leaders and landed gentry. Remarkably, his approach became much ballyhooed. Fenty, his supporters raved, was making the trains run on time. The people were falling off the caboose and being railroaded out of town was just the price of progress. And you conclude Cortland Malloy by writing, quote, "So people went to the polls and politely delivered a message. Most residents actually believe in representative democracy, thank you very much, messy though it might be. You did it, D.C., and if it makes you want to holler, go right ahead," end quote. This column is saying things that are not being said elsewhere with regards to Fenty's defeat.
Yes, the city was started under a three-member commission when there was almost no real population to speak of here. But as the population grew, the city received a little bit of democracy, an elected mayor. This was Boss Shepherd, because we're talking 1800s here. But when the powers that be who really run the city, Congress and, you know, the Board of Trade, business people at the time, started worrying as to whether this city could really be governed, whether people really knew what they were doing, the structure was changed to this three-member commission where people really didn't have a say. Everything was done by fiat. In 1967, Lyndon Johnson and the Home Rule movement in the city, the indigenous grassroots movement, finally came to an agreement and said, we're going to bring democracy to the District of Columbia. We're going to have people, you know, voted in, mayors and school boards and things like that. But to this day, the city does not have full representation in Congress and voting rights. So against that backdrop, you have people making decisions. Adrian Fenty, Peter Nichols, the Attorney General, and Michelle Ree, the Chancellor of Schools, but by fiat, the only representative body in the city right now is the City Council, and Michelle Ree had a billion dollar in change budget, but refused to, you know, tell the people's representatives, the only representatives that the people have on, they're on the city council, what was happening with the money. And it was just untenable on that score. It was done in secrecy, and it was done with an arrogant disregard for openness and honesty, quite frankly. So when people look up and find the effects of the money, you know, more money being allocated to well-to-do areas than to the areas that need them most, people became really upset and started paying attention to the extent to which they were losing the ability to have a government of the people and by the people. And when it turned out that you would have Walmart, for example, the Walmart Foundation saying, look, we're going to give tens of millions of dollars to the school, but Michelle Ree has got to be the one to administer it. So, in other words, you have to keep her in, or else we aren't going to give you the money, which is where I get that little fascism thing, but I'm not trying to sound like Tea Party or anything like that. But when you have a corporation trying to dictate to people how they should decide on who's going to lead their schools, you know, people just get, it becomes very offensive to do that. And that's the kind of thing that people were rebelling against, what the revolt was really about. They wanted control of the school system again. They gave some leeway. They gave the powers that be an inch Let's see what you can do if we clear the way for you. No political obstacles from a school board. Okay, we're going to get that out the way so you can get this stuff done. And to Ree's credit and Fenty's credit, they did some interesting things with the bureaucracy. They really streamlined some things and made people feel good about the time it took to get processes done. But having streamlined some of these processes, it turns out that only worked for a certain group of people. And as the trains sped out of the station to make it to the next stop on time, it just ran over to people who weren't able to access the system like that. A lot is made about how much Michelle Ree can answer your email or how quickly you can get information by computer. But the school survey of parents found that one of the things people in the poorest areas wanted was some way to access a computer. And how do we learn? Can you help us learn how to use this stuff? It hadn't happened. So you have that dynamic going on. Maybe it would have somewhere down the line. But the whole idea was to help these people first because they had the greatest need. It went completely the opposite. People rebel.
Cortland Malloy, before we touch on your very interesting article about Gray and how some people are rooting against him, I interviewed Michelle Ree. You wrote an article on Monday, September 6th, which said Ree's appearance at D.C. Mayor Fenty's rally shows disregard for law. And you write, quote, "I'm here as a private citizen," D.C. Schools Chancellor Michelle Ree said at Saturday's campaign rally for Mayor Adrian M. Fenty. "I consulted with my lawyer, and he told me it was okay to be here as a private citizen." Why does Ree play games like that? The Hatch Act tells government employees not to use their position to influence elections. Maybe that private citizen ruse puts her in compliance with the letter of the law, but she sure comes off as showing an arrogant disregard for the spirit of it, end quote. And I asked Michelle Ree about this on Friday, September 10th. At the Union Station, there was an Impact Awards dinner where these impact evaluations, the teachers were told actually they were getting a bonus of between $3,000 and $25,000. Questioned after, Ree said, "Oh, well, actually, you have to give up rights to get it," which means it wasn't a bonus. But I asked Ree about the Hatch Act, and here's what she said. Chancellor Ree, Cortland Malloy in the Washington Post, he wrote that he has some concerns about the Hatch Act and that you might be violating the spirit of the Hatch Act. You were campaigning a week ago. You haven't campaigned much in the last
week. Absolutely incorrect. If you read the Hatch Act, what it says in the first paragraph of the Hatch Act, it says that Congress encourages all public officials to be engaged, civically engaged. It gives a list of all of the allowable activities. It says you can attend rallies. It says you can, say what candidate that you prefer and that sort of thing. It's very, very clear, and I'm sorry that Mr. Malloy did not read the Hatch Act when he was writing about it.
Those are the words of Chancellor Michelle Ree responding to your article, which said that she may, in fact, have violated the spirit of the Hatch Act by campaigning for Mayor Fenty.
Yes. The Hatch Act says do not use, your elected position to influence, and that is the critical thing. Not that you can campaign, but you can influence. And that's what she was in a position to influence the outcome of this election. And with her own job on the line, if it didn't work out that way. And there's just no way that, there are some fine prints in there about, who, and I don't remember the exact thing about all the little fine print, but the spirit of the law is that government officials, who have things to gain from an election, who have things to gain from it, should be out there doing campaign things. Yeah, Michelle Ree could have, campaigned for, heck, who knows what it could have been. But it was certainly not to campaign on behalf of the guy who would keep her if he won, and by de facto against the person who would probably let her go if she lost. And the fact that she was out there with, as a rock star, on the cover of everything. You see it all over the national news, but also with these strings attached. Vote for me and you get this Walmart money, if you don't, it's not coming. I can't imagine anything, violating the Hatch Act more, in terms of the spirit. And the appearance of it. You know, you can go down to, you know, section D, paragraph 3C, and find a little, maybe a escape loop in this thing. But the fact is, people looked at her as a school chancellor for all the students, basically choosing sides, as if to say, this is my candidate, and this is what she said. If the other guy wins, you know, I don't know if I can stay, you know. And that is just, you know, that's very much in violation as far as I'm concerned. And other people thought so too, the voters.
It was also interesting to know where she campaigned. Chevy Chase, some of the, you know, upper Northwest. She did not go, I don't know that she went east of the river to campaign.
No, she did not. And that's... God, I mean, people say that she and Vindy had a tin ear on these kind of questions because she went to the, you know, predominantly white, well-to-do areas to campaign and did not go into low-income areas. So the signal, I don't know what is the kind of message you're supposed to get, you know, from that. But a lot of people took offense, you know. And again, this is just one of many things that added up. This is just one of many things that added up. You know, I don't want to give the impression that everything that people were looking at were superficial, whether she campaigned, which is bad enough, or, you know, whether she acknowledged, waved or smiled at people. The proof of the pudding was in how the money was allocated, how people were tested, and the fact that test scores are not progressing, that they are in fact going backwards now. And that was the proof of the pudding for it. But all these other things just added to the perception that her real concerns weren't with the people that she claimed they would be with when she came here.
And now Courtland Malloy, Council Chairman Vincent Gray is the presumptive mayor-elect. And in a recent article entitled A Vile Cauldron of Hatred, you write, quote, "Why do so many people seem to be hoping that presumptive D.C. Mayor-elect Vincent Gray will fail? Predicting it. Betting on it. Just you wait and seeing on it. Declaring that his victory in the Democratic primary last week was devastating to black children, as schools chancellor Michelle Reed put it, and that the city is already heading backwards." Talk about, as we finish up here, Courtland Malloy, this attitude that seems to be in certain parts of the city betting against Vincent Gray as mayor.
Well, there, a lot of this was drawn from the Washington Post has an online edition in which people can post anonymous comments about their feelings about election results. And there was a tremendous amount of negative racist spewings about people being angry about Adrian Fenty losing. And this anger became almost like a bet or a hope that Vincent Gray, the person who unseated Adrian Fenty, would fail so they could, you know, have reason for saying, "I told you so." And it was very negative. And not only that, the degree to which black residents were being castigated for their vote and the anger and the racial denigration of black students by many of the people who commented just made me wonder, how can people who are so nasty and have such awfully racist thoughts really be concerned about the welfare of black children? And, you know, my hope is that, you know, the people of goodwill, and this is not everybody, this is not all white people by no stretch of the imagination, it's just my hope that people of goodwill can come together and continue to work in the benefit of the students.
Thanks so much, Courtland Malloy. And any final thoughts you want to share?
No, not really. I just think that school reform is not a one-shot deal. Like I said, the city has been at it for decades now. Every superintendent has come and taken a whack at you know, breaking down the Berlin Wall of education and trying to make things better. Michelle Rhee and Adrian Fenty came. They took their shot, and this is what we're left with now. And I think that the energies must be we must use energies to learn, you know, from the mistakes that were made and simply push on. You know, there's a lot of times it's the failed experiments which teach us the most. And there's a lot to learn from this experiment, not the least of which is that if you're going to try to reform a school system, you need to try to get as many of the stakeholders on your side. You're trying to reform a system and not perpetrate reform on people. So that's, I hope we move forward on a more positive note from here on out.
Thanks so much.